Chapter 13. Yes, sir. It would. Stern stuck out his chin cheerily and blinked at close quarters with that unconscious impudence which had the power to enrage Massey beyond anything. The engineer spoke very distinctly. Listen well to me then, Mr. Stern. I wouldn't, do you hear? I wouldn't promise you the value of 2 pence for anything you can tell me. He struck Stern's arm away with a smart blow, and catching hold of the handle, pulled the door to. The terrific slam darkened the cabin instantaneously to his eye, as if after the flash of an explosion. At once he dropped into the chair. H, no. You don't. He whispered faintly. The ship had in that place to shave the bank so close that the gigantic wall of leaves came gliding like a shutter against the port. The darkness of the primeval forest seemed to flow into that bare cabin with the odor of rotting leaves, of sodden soil, the strong muddy smell of the living earth steaming uncovered after the passing of a deluge. The bushes swished loudly alongside. Above there was a series of crackling sounds, with a sharp rain of small broken branches falling on the bridge. A creeper with a great rustle snapped on the head of a boat davit, and a long, luxuriant green twig actually whipped in and out of the open port, leaving behind a few torn leaves that remained suddenly at rest on Mr. Massey's blanket. Then, the ship sheering out in the stream, the light began to return, but did not augment beyond a subdued clearness. For the sun was very low already, and the river, wending its sinuous course through a multitude of secular trees, as if at the bottom of a precipitous gorge, had been already invaded by a deepening gloom, the swift precursor of the night. Oh, no, you don't, murmured the engineer again. His lips trembled almost imperceptibly, his hands too, a little. And to calm himself he opened the writing desk, spread out a sheet of thin grayish paper covered with a mass of printed figures, and began to scan them attentively for the 20th time this trip at least. With his elbows propped, his head between his hands, he seemed to lose himself in the study of an abstruse problem in mathematics. It was the list of the winning numbers from the last drawing of the great lottery which had been the one inspiring fact of so many years of his existence. The conception of a life deprived of that periodical sheet of paper had slipped away from him entirely, as another man, according to his nature, would not have been able to conceive a world without fresh air, without activity, or without affection. A great pile of flimsy sheets had been growing for years in his desk, while the Cephala, driven by the faithful Jack, wore out her boilers in tramping up and down the straits, from cape to cape, from river to river, from bay to bay, accumulating by that hard labor of an overworked, starved ship the blackened mass of these documents. Massey kept them under lock and key like a treasure. There was in them, as in the experience of life, the fascination of hope, the excitement of a half-penetrated mystery, the longing of a half-satisfied desire. For days together, on a trip, he would shut himself up in his berth with them. The thump of the toiling engines pulsated in his ear, and he would weary his brain poring over the rows of disconnected figures, bewildering by their senseless sequence, resembling the hazards of destiny itself. He nourished a conviction that there must be some logic lurking somewhere in the results of chance. He thought he had seen its very form. His head swam. His limbs ached. He puffed at his pipe mechanically. A contemplative stupor would soothe the fretfulness of his temper, like the passive bodily quietude procured by a drug, while the intellect remains tensely on the stretch. 9, 9, 0, 4, 2. He made a note. The next winning number of the great prize was 47,005. These numbers, of course, would have to be avoided in the future when writing to Manila for the tickets. He mumbled, pencil in hand. Dot and five. HM dot 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 HM. He wetted his finger. The papers rustled. Ha! But what's this? 3 years ago, in the September drawing, it was number 9, 0, 4. Two that took the first prize. Most remarkable. There was a hint there of a definite rule. He was afraid of missing some recondite principle in the overwhelming wealth of his material. What could it be? And for half an hour he would remain dead still, bent low over the desk, without twitching a muscle. At his back the whole berth would be thick with a heavy body of smoke, as if a bomb had burst in there, unnoticed, unheard. At last he would lock up the desk with the decision of unshaken confidence, jump and go out. He would walk swiftly back and forth on that part of the foredeck which was kept clear of the lumber, and of the bodies of the native passengers. They were a great nuisance, but they were also a source of profit that could not be disdained. He needed every penny of profit the Cephala could make. Little enough it was, in all conscience. The incertitude of chance gave him no concern, since he had somehow arrived at the conviction that, in the course of years, every number was bound to have his winning turn. It was simply a matter of time, and of taking as many tickets as he could afford for every drawing. He generally took rather more. All the earnings of the ship went that way, and also the wages he allowed himself as chief engineer. It was the wages he paid to others that he begrudged with a reasoned, and at the same time a passionate regret. He scowled at the Lascars with their deck brooms, at the quartermasters rubbing the brass rails with greasy rags. He was eager to shake his fist, and roar abuse in bad Malay at the poor carpenter, a timid, sickly, opium-fuddled Chinaman, in loose blue drawers for all costume, who invariably dropped his tools and fled below, with streaming tail and shaking all over, before the fury of that devil. But it was when he raised up his eyes to the bridge, where one of these sailor frauds was always planted by law in charge of his ship, that he felt almost dizzy with rage. He abominated them all. It was an old feud, from the time he first went to sea, an unlicked cub with a great opinion of himself, in the engine room. The slights that had been put upon him. The persecutions he had suffered at the hands of skippers of absolute nobodies in a steamship after all. And now that he had risen to be a shipowner they were still a plague to him. He had absolutely to pay away precious money to the conceited useless loafers. As if a fully qualified engineer who was the owner as well were not fit to be trusted with the whole charge of a ship. Well, he made it pretty warm for them. But it was a poor consolation. He had come in time to hate the ship too for the repairs she required, for the coal bills he had to pay, for the poor beggarly freights she earned. He would clench his hand as he walked, and hit the rail a sudden blow, viciously, as though she could be made to feel pain. And yet he could not do without her. He needed her. He must hang on to her tooth and nail to keep his head above water till the expected flood of fortune came sweeping up, and landed him safely on the high shore of his ambition. It was now to do nothing, nothing whatever, and have plenty of money to do it on. He had tasted of power, the highest form of it. His limited experience was aware of the power of shipowning. What a deception! Vanity of vanities! He wondered at his folly. He had thrown away the substance for the shadow. Of the gratification of wealth he did not know enough to excite his imagination with any visions of luxury. How could he, the child of a drunken boilermaker going straight from the workshop into the engine room of a North Country collier? But the notion of the absolute idleness of wealth he could very well conceive. He reveled in it, to forget his present troubles. He imagined himself walking about the streets of Hull. He knew their gutters well as a boy, with his pockets full of sovereigns. He would buy himself a house. His married sisters, their husbands, his old workshop chums, would render him infinite homage. There would be nothing to think of. His word would be law. He had been out of work for a long time, before he won his prize, and he remembered how Carlo Marianai, commonly known as Ponchy Charlie, the Maltese hotel keeper at the slummy end of Denham Street, had cringed joyfully before him in the evening, when the news had come. Poor Charlie, though he made his living by ministering to various abject vices, gave credit for their food to many a piece of white wreckage. He was naively overjoyed at the idea of his old bills being paid, and he reckoned confidently on a spell of festivities in the cavernous grog shop downstairs. Massey remembered the curious, respectful looks of the rashy white men in the place. His heart had swelled within him. Massey had left Charlie's infamous den directly he had realized the possibilities open to him, and with his nose in the air. Afterwards, the memory of these adulations was a great sadness. This was the true power of money, and no trouble with it, nor any thinking required either. He thought with difficulty and felt vividly. To his blunt brain, the problems offered by any ordered scheme of life seemed in their cruel toughness to have been put in his way by the obvious malevolence of men. As a shipowner, everyone had conspired to make him a nobody. How could he have been such a fool as to purchase that accursed ship? He had been abominably swindled. There was no end to this swindling. And as the difficulties of his improvident ambition gathered thicker around him, he really came to hate everybody he had ever come in contact with. A temper naturally irritable, and an amazing sensitiveness to the claims of his own personality had ended by making of life for him a sort of inferno, a place where his lost soul had been given up to the torment of savage brooding. But he had never hated anyone so much as that old man who had turned up one evening to save him from another disaster, from the conspiracy of the wretched sailors. He seemed to have fallen on board from the sky. His footsteps echoed on the empty steamer, and the strange deep-toned voice on deck repeating interrogatively the words, "Mr. Massey, Mr. Massey there," had been startling like a wonder. And coming up from the depths of the cold engine room, where he had been pottering dismally with a candle amongst the enormous shadows, thrown on all sides by the skeleton limbs of machinery, Massey had been struck dumb by astonishment in the presence of that imposing old man with a beard like a silver plate, towering in the dusk rendered lurid by the expiring flames of sunset. "Want to see me on business?" "What business?" "I am doing no business." "Can't you see that this ship is laid up?" Massey had turned at bay before the pursuing irony of his disaster. Afterwards, he could not believe his ears. What was that old fellow getting at? Things don't happen that way. It was a dream. He would presently wake up and find the man vanished like a shape of mist. The gravity, the dignity, the firm and courteous tone of that athletic old stranger impressed Massey. He was almost afraid. But it was no dream. £500 are no dream. At once he became suspicious. What did it mean? Of course it was an offer to catch hold of for dear life. But what could there be behind? Before they had parted, after appointing a meeting in a solicitor's office early on the morrow, Massey was asking himself, what is his motive? He spent the night in hammering out the clauses of the agreement, a unique instrument of its sort whose tenor got bruited abroad somehow, and became the talk and wonder of the port. Massey's object had been to secure for himself as many ways as possible of getting rid of his partner without being called upon at once to pay back his share. Captain Wally's efforts were directed to making the money secure. Was it not Ivy's money, a part of her fortune whose only other asset was the time-defying body of her old father? Sure of his forbearance in the strength of his love for her, he accepted, with stately serenity, Massey's stupidly cunning paragraphs against his incompetence, his dishonesty, his drunkenness, for the sake of other stringent stipulations. At the end of 3 years he was at liberty to withdraw from the partnership, taking his money with him. Provision was made for forming a fund to pay him off. But if he left the Cephala before the term, from whatever cause, barring death, Massey was to have a whole year for paying. Illness, the lawyer had suggested. A young man fresh from Europe, and not overburdened with business, who was rather amused. Massey began to whine unctuously. How could he be expected? Let that go. Captain Wally had said with a superb confidence in his body. CTS of God, he added. In the midst of life we are in death, but he trusted his maker with a still greater fearlessness, his maker who knew his thoughts, his human affections, and his motives. His creator knew what use he was making of his health, how much he wanted it. Trust my first illness will be my last. I've never been ill, that I can remember, he had remarked. Edit go. But at this early stage he had already awakened Massey's hostility, by refusing to make it 600 instead of 5. Cannot do that, was all he had said, simply, but with so much decision, that Massey desisted at once from pressing the point, but had thought to himself, can't. Old curmudgeon. Won't. He must have lots of money, but he would like to get hold of a soft berth, and the sixth part of my profits for nothing, if he only could. And during these years Massey's dislike grew under the restraint of something resembling fear. The simplicity of that man appeared dangerous. Of late he had changed, however, had appeared less formidable, and with a lessened vigor of life, as though he had received a secret wound. But still he remained incomprehensible in his simplicity, fearlessness, and rectitude. And when Massey learned that he meant to leave him at the end of the time, to leave him confronted with the problem of boilers, his dislike blazed up secretly into hate. It had made him so clear-eyed that for a long time now Mr. Stern could have told him nothing he did not know. He had much ado in trying to terrorize that mean sneak into silence. He wanted to deal alone with Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.